Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, I am recording episode 254, I believe. And we talk a lot about on this show about language, translation, transcreation, terminology. But there is a question that I've been sitting with lately, that what if language, for instance, is actually the last thing you should adapt when you go global? What if the real work is understanding why a customer in Seoul or Sao Paulo or Stockholm trusts differently, decide differently, expect something fundamentally different from the same product? Now, after 30 years in the industry, I've watched companies pour millions of dollars into multilingual content still fail in market. And I think today's conversation is going to explain exactly why this happening. My guest today is Shui Shui Tan, and Shui Shui joined me from London, England, and I would like to welcome Shui Shui to the conversation. Let's get into it. So today we are going to be talking about a few things. But before we get started on the actual discussion, what I wanted to do is initially is, as we do on the channel all the time here, for our guest is to introduce herself. And the way we ask our guests to introduce themselves is by asking them the story question. And here it comes. What is your story?
Thank you. So my story. So I'm actually originally from Malaysia. I'm Malaysian Chinese. That means my grandparents are from Taiwan and south of China. And I believe third generation. I don't know how much most of the audiences would know about Malaysia. Like we have quite a big, three big ethnicity, like Malay, Chinese, and Indians. And so, yeah, in that country itself, have a lot of culture going on and so on. And bear with me because the whole topic we are talking today is because it's culture. That's why I describe a lot about where I'm coming from. I spent half of my life in Malaysia and then I moved to the UK for the other part, half of my life. So I have been in the UK for more than 20 years now. And so my background is actually, if we go back really, my first degree is actually mechanical engineering, mechanical industrial engineering. And then after that, I actually start working with a Japanese company, which is really interesting because I start to see a Japanese culture when they work, like you have to do exercise together with the management team all together at 8:00 a.m. And then you don't leave until your boss leaves because so that you can show you're working hard and things like that. But after that, I came to the UK and I did a master in music technology. But what actually led to what I'm doing now is I did a PhD in human computer interactions. And that's about user experience and how to make experience better for your customers or people using it. And I was being very lucky because at the very beginning of my career, I get to travel with Marriott International Hotel because this is back to, 18 years ago. It's one of the very few companies at that time who actually recognized that the experience people are looking for might be different from country to country. So we start to work together. I travel with them to China, to Japan, to Mexico, Qatar, and every places to understand how people go about booking holidays, booking hotels, and so on. So that becomes what I'm doing now, focusing very much on culturalizations. So that's a sum up of who I am and my short stories.
You know, this is phenomenal because for the audience, Chu Tan is the founder of Bayo Global and the author of Research Global Growth. And her list of clients is you know, significant enough to tell you the whole story. I mean, she's got customers like Netflix, Spotify, Bumble, and Asana, The Washington Post, Marriott, you mentioned Marriott earlier, and Fiverr, and Storytel, and over 16 plus years in research led across
more than 50 markets. And this is pretty amazing, to be honest with you. And you sit at the crossroad of culturalization, because you mentioned, you know, you come from a Malaysia, which you have a melting pot of cultures as well in there. So that must have impacted you. And the research studies that you've done during your PhD, that probably influenced how you got into some of these customers and how you're working with them now. So tell us a little bit more, if you don't mind, about Bayou Global and about some of the customers you work with.
Yeah. Initially, when we focused very much on looking into helping businesses to kind of understand, talking to users, their customers, and understand what they need, what they wanted, is very basic in that sense in terms of learning from the users and customers. But throughout the last 10 years, I actually focusing more, even more on not just looking at what people want and what people like, but also the ecosystem they are in. For example, if you are talking about one country or one market, you think about their political issues or their economy or their infrastructure. Sometimes I go even as far as understanding their history of the country, because those are actually very important in shaping what people value and how people behave and so on, and what people need for a product. So when a customer's company comes to me, they always sometimes saying, oh, we want to go to another market, or we want to grow in one market. They sometimes very often think about localizations, which really very much, as you would know, like they think about just the language itself. We translate and we will be fine, right? We translate to their local language. But actually what they need is culturalization. So it's a term that I kind of coined it. It's not in the dictionary, but I think if I say it, everyone will know what that means, right? Like it's about cultural. So for me, like localization or translation, very much people will talk about the words, but culturalization is more about a lot of assumptions that we need to understand what is behind the story of the people that we are designing for and so on. So that is what I'm focusing on, to help companies to understand what actually people, not just what people read, which is the language, but it's also to understand what people understand about your products or your category, and what your customers in the country do and expect from your business, so you can make the right decisions on the strategy you want to go for that specific countries. So I work with, like, for example, Spotify is one of my key clients. I've been working with them continuously for the last 9 years now across different parts of the business on propositions, like finding the right propositions for different countries, or identify new propositions for different countries, or in terms of their local strategy, like how they should actually adapt marketing-wise or payment-wise, what they should look into and so on. So that is what I work a lot with them on different places. Like Bumble, it was like, we want to go to Japan. Bumble is for those who didn't know, it's actually, I don't know if you know about Bumble, it's an online dating app.
I don't know about it until I read about it. I was reading
exactly. That's what I always think. Everyone, of course, know Bumble because I used it myself before.
Of course, I left the dating scene a long time ago before I met my wife. So
keep it that way. Bumble is online dating app, so they wanted to go to the Japan and say, okay, what should we? They're already in Japan, but not doing as well as they would want to. So yeah, I went into to kind of help them to understand the scene, the cultural elements, like the traditions, should women make the first move as the Bumble should be? Because Bumble is like, if you swipe, woman and man's match, the woman used to have to make the first move, like saying hi, before the man can do anything, which is different from the other online apps. But there was just like, is that too much for the traditions in Japan, where women should be more, less proactive and so on? And also their features, their payment method, how much did you charge, and the scene, because like in Japan, like what people care about for their partners might be very different from what in the UK or Canada or North America and something. So yeah, I kind of help them to understand that and look into the bigger picture, and then build the same build the right propositions and strategy for them?
Now, the name Beyo is like beyond, I'm assuming. I did some translation on that one. And so what does beyond mean to you in practice? Beyond what exactly, and how did the philosophy shape what you offer to your customer?
Yeah, that's really great. No one ever, I thought you actually might have seen my website that mentioned that, but no one ever have actually made that link. But actually, that is exactly how I came up with the name, because I thought beyond is too like out there. Like I want to be like a bit shorter. So for me at that time, beyond is beyond what people thinking about a culture or what they understand about a community, a society, and so on. So for me, it's like going beyond that assumptions that you know about a place and so on. And the other thing is because Mandarin and Taiwanese are both my first language. And in Mandarin, Beiyo is not exactly that, but it sounds Beiyo, sounds like preparations and in preparation, equipped with. And I just like, that's really good in combinations of equipped with something that with knowledge to go beyond what everyone should do, what everyone should do for different markets that you go into. So thank you for asking that question, because like, you know, running a business, you have a logo, you have a name, and then you just go on and do your business and never come back to reflect. That is actually a lot of meaning within that.
This is exactly why I asked the question, because I find it very, very informative to put that in the name. A lot of people, they call their businesses different names, but this is on purpose. It was done that way. And it's sort of like, from talking to you for a few minutes, it feels like it's reflective of what you're doing. Exactly that. And, you know, I work in the localization industry for the past 30 years. So it feels to me, you know, a lot of times customers come to the localization industry and they say, you know what? We've got a website, or we've got a user manual, or we got a marketing campaign, and we're going to launch this in 10 countries. Please translate. Mm. And, you know, for over the year, this is how it started. For over the years, we're making a little bit of a progress in terms of educating the customer on, you know, not necessarily straight translation, but necessarily perhaps understanding what you translate, who you're translating for, and what the actual translation should look like. Now, there's always the, you know, my listeners from the localization industry will probably jump up and down saying, oh, the customer is not paying us enough to do the entire cycle of research, you know, classification of what we need to translate, how do we translate it? And that's fine. But at the same time, we should educate the customer on the need of having the right content to be translated in the right way to the right demographics. Somebody came on the podcast here not too long ago, and they were talking to me about, you know, the mobile phone, for instance, in an Asian country. I'm not going to name anybody right now because I'll give it away. So it's in an Asian country where, you know, the population is about 125 million people in that country, and the mobile phone is being used in English because the translation is wrong. They can't use it in their own native language because, you know, whoever translated this did not take the time to understand the culture. You know, back to your comment earlier, you need to understand that cultural aspect of where you're going in order for you to take your company there, to take your product and services successfully to that market. And that's a great service you guys are offering.
Yeah, it's very important. It's not just like translate and that's it. And I'm sure that you talk about it a lot in the past, and as well that even translate in one language in Canada and France and Switzerland, they're all very different because you use different slang and different contexts and so on. The other thing about translation as well is that as you're talking about Asia and people were saying like you are talking about using it in a different language and so on, it's just something popping in my mind is that in, like Malaysia, the example, like we have so many languages happening, right? Malay is the in our national language. Actually, so a lot of, there's one company, this is many years ago, there's a company say, oh, we translate into Malay, but hardly anyone use that website. And why is that? We spend so much money translating. And little did they know that actually in Malaysia, English is actually widely spoken and most websites actually in English. And so you actually didn't even have to translate. You just have to localize it in other ways, in your products, in your other things, rather than spending that money into. So it's doing a bit of research and understanding a bit more before you just like blindly, we need to translate, just translate. That is it.
Now, you've worked across 50 plus markets and for the past 16 years. Did your own cultural background help you, you know, your lived experience navigate between cultures and shaped how you see things? I guess when you come from that cultural background and you've seen this growing up, I guess, in your home country or your family, help you shape what the, you know, what Western strategists right now, they have to, you know, go to school to study, you know, get, you know, some academic background into it, but you sort of natively grew into it. Am I correct?
Yes and no. I think in hindsight, yes. But when I was in it, I didn't. It's just now looking back, I say, like, oh yeah, I can see the connections. Maybe that's why, because as we all know, like when you're in a culture or you're in an environment that is so familiar to you, that is a norm to you. Like you wouldn't even like, oh, that I'm doing something different from other countries. I'm doing something different from until you go out and you experience another culture, then you say, and then you have frictions or you observe certain things, people do things differently, then you will realize there's a cultural differences. But I think in when I was young in Malaysia, it was a bit slightly different because we're in that culture that everyone blend together. Like, oh yeah, I celebrate this and you celebrate that and you have your religion and festival. Oh, you have fasting, then we all like respect that. Or when communication is slightly different. So we just absorb that and just get used to it. So I think when I was young, I probably didn't realize that is happening until I come to the UK. Of course, as you can imagine, there's so many different so many things that are different. Like I'm now quite British in my way to say things like, oh, that's interesting. And then it's like, oh, that's not good. I was talking to, I have a post the other day on LinkedIn. I was talking about a personal story where I went back during Chinese New Year early this year, and my sister was saying, oh yeah, my boyfriend, my partner's parents will keep saying like to my mom, like he likes this dish that my mom made using yam, and keep hinting that he wanted my mom to do more, make more, and so that he can have it. I just like, well, how did he hint it, right? Like for me, I just like, how did he say it to him? My sister said, well, he said that, oh, mom, this is so good, and mom is so good at making it. I'm just like, that is it? That is the hint? Because for me, that is any British will politely say, like, oh, that's nice. You're really good at making that, even though they hated it or they didn't want you to make it for them anymore. Like, so I'm just like,
that's sounds like my mother. That was like my mother. I tell her, you know, I tell her I like this dish, and I say, okay. God bless her. She's 83 years old now.
Yeah.
And she lives 2 hours of flight away from me.
Yeah.
So every time I go, she makes me the same dishes. I love
because
that.
Because you say like, but did you mean it?
Well, of course I meant it. I did not. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's your mother's, so it's your mother's cooking. You can't lie to that.
Yeah. So you do that. That is good that you mean it. But I think a lot of like politeness in the British culture is like, thank you. Very polite. Right. So I just like, okay, I actually, even though I grew up in that culture, my year have changed because I'm Britishized, I guess there's no word for that. But so I read it in a different way. So yeah, so it's interesting how you can grow in one culture and then you live in the other culture and you're so embedded in that and it's slightly differently. But I think because of how I moved different culture and it makes, when I get into this industry about, oh, learning how people from different countries do certain things differently, I think it triggers something in me that I'm more observant on that. I'm picking up more on the differences. And plus, I'm quite curious as well, as you can tell at the earlier conversation before we start recording. So I'm quite curious. So I always were like, oh, why do they say this? But I wouldn't have thought in that way. So I start to say, I can see why they say that way. And then I go and research even more, like, their culture, their history actually shape who they are and why they are. And that's why they say things in this way, but not in that way and so on. So I think it's a blend of everything that led me to what I do. And hopefully, like everyone, like my clients do things that I'm doing a good job, right? Like for it, that's why I'm passionate about this topic.
Now, for the audience, our guest Chu-Yi wrote a book, authored a book called "Research for Global Growth." Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask a question around: can you walk us through the core research methodology you've built? Specifically, what does it reveal that a standard, perhaps market research a company or in-country agency brief tends to miss?
So because my background is user experience, so my focus was very much user research at that time. It's like talking to users, like interviewing people about what they do think, observe what they do, or ethnography, like following them around to see where they live and how they do things instead of getting them to tell us. So very much the initial research approach that our standard one is like user interviews, like interviewing people, asking a lot of why and understanding their rationale behind of every single mentality and expectations and needs they do, they have. But actually it's now become for me, the research in understanding different culture and different markets is bigger than that, because people as human, you don't always know why you behave a certain way, because this is what I do. This is what we do here. Like, why do you ask me why? Without realizing it's actually very different from what other cultures are doing, right? So a lot of times it's combinations of the research could be interviews or could be ethnography or could be diary study, get them to journal about things so we can review back and say, oh, that's interesting. Can you tell us why you were doing this on certain day and so on? Or could be survey, which is a bigger, you know, like standard surveys that you ask people what to do and so on. But a lot of times what I actually tend to do even more is actually doing understanding what area to look into, because it's for different category of products or industry, the things that you need to look into for certain markets could be different. So take examples like a few years ago, I was in Japan for two clients. One is Spotify and one for Asana. Asana is a work management tool, right?
That was my next question.
Okay, I save it. Next question. So the two, like I was there for a few weeks, and some of the weeks is on Spotify to understand the users. And then the second part of the weeks was with Asana. But the things that we, even though it's the same culture, Japan, even though it's the same culture, but the things that we're looking into is very different. So Asana will be very much about hierarchical, like you need to know, understand there's a hierarchical elements within the culture, that people are very hierarchical, and also consensus, like we want to have the harmony. So everyone has to agree in certain points before we make a decision. Or for example, Asana is about assigning small tasks with four different people, but little, like the main point is actually in Japan, it's very rude to assign a task for someone without even talking to them face to face first, because then you're assuming they're free. You're assuming that they are capable in doing what you want them to do. So it's really rude. You put pressure on them. So, you know, all those things, the things that we look into, cultural aspect we look into for Asana is completely different from Spotify, right? All those doesn't matter to Spotify, whether they're consensus or hierarchical or anything. But for Spotify, it's more about identity. Like, why are they care so much about having the CD? Why are they caring so much about having the poster? You know, like, why do they want CD rather than subscriptions and so on? And how they actually want to view themselves as karaoke. They want to practice music before they go karaoke with friends because of they don't embarrass everyone. And, you know, like the cultural aspect is very different from category to category, even within the same culture. So that's why actually I created a 27 cultural dimension to say the things that you could look into, like you want to look into the physical, the digital infrastructure of a countries, because that might influence how they behave. Like in South Korea, their technology and infrastructure for Wi-Fi is so advanced, so quick, available everywhere, fast internet. So download is not important to them at all. So if you have a subscription, say, oh, you subscribe, then you get to download. That is not enticing to them because they don't need to download anything. They can access internet anywhere they wanted. So there are different aspects that you need to look into. Like, for example, religion is something you want to think about before you go into a market. For example, in Saudi Arabia, when Ramadan happening, the fasting period happening, like people will tend to not listen to music, not watching any videos or anything, or movies, because they just want to study Quran or listen to Quran and so on. So at that point, then what does that mean to your product? You might want to have a pause feature so that in that month, they don't have to cancel it because they're not using it. They just pause it for 1 month, automatically come back. So these are a different aspect you should look into for that is relevant to your product and your category. And then you can make decisions on that.
And, you know, we have a lot of examples of things that went wrong, right? And I'm sure you know them, where companies, they took a product manufactured or service in a region A or country A, and they tried to take it global. And didn't go anywhere. I mean, there are few examples of those. Plus, a lot of times what people do is, I'm thinking about one particular company. It's a large coffee company. Everybody drinks it around the world. It's based in Seattle. I don't know. I'm not going to name any further than that. I just gave you a bit of a precision on it. But at the same time, these guys, you know, they have stores around the world. And I interviewed somebody from Australia on my channel. You've seen the one with Cynthia Deering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she gave the example of how they launched, I think, about 180 stores in Australia, mm-hmm. and they ended up closing them or closing the majority of them, mm-hmm. because, you know, coffee is, you know, maybe interesting in the way it was brewed, served in North America. But for the Australians, maybe it's not something that they would look into because that's not how they drink coffee. And the minimal investment that is required to do the research, you know, upfront versus, you know, reverse engineer all this after you deploy, after you go out to the market, it baffles my mind. Like, spend a little bit of money at the front end, do your research correctly, do the step correctly. That's better than you deploy, you rush to market, and then you come back and say, oops, it didn't work. It just doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It's afterthought.
Yeah, but I know it makes sense to us, right? Like, but there's so many companies are doing this mistake. I think it's rather like, oh, we know. I think there are a few layers into that. One is like, it's a lot of time is from the management, right? Like, because that is the decision they're going to make, just launch or be doing a bit of money, or we want to invest in something. I think there are a lot of assumptions that they think they know the market quite well because they speak English. They speak the same language. They should be the same. They are friends.
Well, here's the good one for you. I've heard it many times, is that I hear people telling me, oh, we've got somebody from Malaysia, for instance, if they're going to Malaysia, right? Yeah. We've got somebody from Malaysia works in the office in London. Oh, that means you knew the culture, like the whole culture now it's encapsulated in one individual that works in your office. Good for you.
And that is a very, not just that, like, but also very dangerous because if you rely on one person, that person either are not very aware of the cultural differences because, as we said earlier, not everyone is attuned to finding out the differences. And secondly, it's very subjective view. It's their view of what the people around them, around that person do. It's assumptions that, yeah, we all do that there, but is that true? Or is that just the segment that he's in or she's in that do that? So yeah, for a high risk initiatives like launching a new market, to rely on one particular market is very different. And sometimes they also say, oh, we have salesperson in the locals, because it's very often businesses don't have a big team in different locations, but just have a sales representatives. And they will rely on that sales representative to tell them what they want or what they needed and so on. There was one company that I was talking to that they were saying about, oh, they are those kind, you know, a bit like those kind of kits, luggage where they have different shapes, but the kids can sit on the top. Again, not naming names, but I think there are a few brands on that as well. I remember talking to one of their growth team as well. Just, yeah, our salespeople in Japan keep saying we need four wheels rather than two wheels, because that's how kids are doing and they need it to be. But just like, and then he's just like, it's not going to sales because kids don't want to seem like they are playing, because those is quite fun, right? Like you can sit on it, you can play on it in the airport. And the salespeople were saying in Japan were saying like, oh no, Japan kids is actually want to be seen very good kids, obedient, so not running around in the airport and so on. So we can't do much about that market. There's no product market fit. I was just like, how about you change the story? Because in Japan, the kids are very disciplined. They do their own thing. They wash their dishes in the school. Even they are 3, 4, 5. They go to school by themselves in the morning. And so there's a lot of discipline. How about you talk about it? Is you own your own luggage and you can actually pack your things by yourself. And this is your luggage that you actually can carry. And so you turn that story in a slightly different to fit into that market. So there's a product market fit. It's not like a lot of companies saying like, we don't have product market fit in that country. We should just leave that market. I think it's an assumptions market fit that market assumptions fit that actually a lot of companies did it wrong. They make a lot of assumptions about how people should behave, how should people will use their product and so on, and just miss that completely and not doing that.
Do you find, Chui, that the manufacturers nowadays are more interested, because they weren't before? I mean, years ago, they would just say, okay, you can't adapt to my product, don't buy it. I think there's a little bit more pressure now on service company, product company, software company to adapt to local markets if they want to go global. Like one version, let's say, let's assume this way, like one version of your product is not sufficient anymore to accommodate everybody around the globe anymore. You have to create, I guess, a modification of your product to fit certain markets if that's of interest to you. Am I correct?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think they can't afford not to do that anymore, right? Like first of all, is like, if you want to grow outside your home market, you need to explore somewhere else. Your home is not enough anymore for your growth. Secondly, like it or not, your product, even in your home market, are going to be used by people from different culture. They are living, and even you don't launch in there, they might start using it, whether they are in the market or outside the market as well. Even China, they are so, for such a long time, they were so embedded in their own market, because they don't need to go outside because their population is big enough to cover their growth and so on. So when I started doing international research and helping companies on that, I got a lot of work for international company outside China to want to go China, say, help us to understand Chinese market and so on. I rarely get the other way around. But these few years, a lot is the other way around. Chinese company wants to come up from China and so that they can start looking into the Southeast Asia market or even Europe and so on. Because if you want to grow, you have to grow bigger than where you are at now. And also, I kind of see this whole localization, culturalizations in, maybe we have been going through four era. The first era, this is many years ago, also can tell my age, so how long I've been working and all my age and so on. It's like we've gone through a period where nothing needs to be localized. If you want to use my product, just use it as how we launch it, right? And they grow, that's fine. People are not picky about that. And then we've gone through an era where 90s, where people start to translate, that they translate the language and do the bare minimum. And that is good enough. They might do a bit of like dates, formatting changes, and all those kind of different tiny little things or currency changes and so on. And that was good enough at that time. And then the third era will be, yeah, we do a bit more than that. We will change payment method. We change social media so that we adapt a bit more on that. But now we are going through the process that if you only do all those that you just gone through, then you're actually behind. People are not going to use your product because it doesn't fit into their culture. So now we are going through this period, like you say, not just digital, not just manufacturing, everyone like fintech, edtech, health tech, every single one company actually have to be doing more than just language, more than just the changing payment method and so on, but actually finding way on your propositions, your positioning, your product features, your marketing, everyone has everything.
Even the pricing in a lot of cases too, right?
Pricing, because, of course.
You know, if you can afford $50 a month in Canada or in the US, maybe some other countries, $50 is like a month's salary. How are you going to sell your product?
You need to fit into the market and so on. So yeah, market fit in some countries has to be lower. There are every single elements that you can think of touch on. If your products then will be, IKEA was a good example that I actually quite like using each time, because before they go to India, they did a very big research. They go to thousands of houses in India to understand how people live, how people functions in as a community and so on. So it has been very successful. They did that because they failed in other markets before without doing much. And they know India is very hard to break. But if they break it, it's great. So they did that. And what they changed their products, like on what are the things that is needed. The bed, because a lot of kids are actually sleeping with their parents until they are quite old in India. So they have beds for parents and the kids. The cabinets they're selling, because they sometimes wash with water on the floors. So all the kitchen cabinet has to have gaps at the bottom for the water to go through. So they changed it in the products. They change it on the operation side, like working with the locals, use the wood that actually can fit into that humid environment that India is. But also their cafe, they don't have the IKEA famous Swedish meatball. They have that, but not only that, they have samosas or vegetarian meatball and so on, because there are a lot of vegetarian and in India. So they actually do it in touch points on their showrooms, because Asians or Indians populations are a bit shorter, women especially. So they make the showrooms counter a lot lower so that it fits into. So you can see they touch on every single point. It's the same if you're digital. It should be touched on every single point, like you say.
Correct. Now, let's talk a little bit about the customer behavior, trust, and value cross market, because trust is one of those things. It's very hard to put a frame in the framework. If you put it around and you'd say, well, can I operationalize trust? How do I operationalize trust? Is there a concrete example in your engagements where you're created this whole trust framework from a customer behavior, value, trust, and product expectation to a lot of extent. Is there a way to operationalize trust in your opinion?
Is that a way to operationalize trust? In some ways you could. Trust, if we step back and say, like, what is trust? If we pick trust, but it's because trust is a funny one, because it's probably one of the most common things that I have seen over the 17, 18 years when doing research and also understand different markets for different clients, because you can say actually the trust, in some way, trust could mean a lot of things on different countries, right? Like it could be trust means like, I don't trust this product because I never have heard about this brand before. Or it could be, then that is awareness issues, right? That you need to fix. But it also could be like, the trust issues could be, I actually don't want to put my credit cards on the apps or any website because I have a trust issues on how payments and scams are happening in our countries a lot. Like in Kenya, we heard that a lot as well. Like, oh, I'm very careful about which website to use or what where I put my account and so on. Or it could be like the trust is like, I don't trust it's easy for me to cancel a subscriptions. I don't trust it, so I don't want to do it and so on. So it could be privacy or anything else. So there are a lot of different levels on trust on that instance. So it's really important to see, even when someone say, I don't trust it, what does that mean? We have to dig deeper into that. Like I was helping a company, online job portal company. It's a bit like Indeed equivalent, but they are bigger in Asia and Southeast Asia and Australia and New Zealand. We were looking into Indonesia. It's like, what does trust mean for hirer and candidates? Is that trust about anything? But for them, the trust is, actually, it's a word of mouth that someone told me about that job, that company, then I can trust it more. And then because I have that connections, then I'm a bit easier to get in. And it's like, why is it aligned with hirer? If it is a candidate that they know from someone else or is there a trust element, then they are more likely to be able to find out more information about the candidate. So in that instant, the trust is very different from the trust that we are thinking of when in the UK or in the Western world, that when you look for a job or hiring someone, the trust is slightly different in that how it manifested. So in some way you can operationalize it, but in some way it's like, yes, it's depending on your category again, like any aspect. You just need to look into, when people say trust, what does that mean? Can we break it down? Can we look into it in the different angles on what they are and so on? And that can apply for any other things like value or everything else that, other than trust.
No, there are a few things that companies probably, I think they're blind to it, systematically blind to it. Mm-hmm. And out of the four pillars that you built the framework on, which my understanding is customer behavior, value, trust, and product expectation, where do you think most systematically companies are ignoring out of the four pillars? Why do you think they do that? Is it out of cost? Is it out of ignorance and lack of understanding?
I think it's the lack of, I don't want to say ignorant, because ignorance seems like we don't care, but in some way it's like we say, like we know enough to go into it. So, and that touch on cost, that could be touch on timing.
The assumptions that we know basically, right?
Yeah, it's always, we know it all. It's like always, not it all, but a lot of times it's like, we know enough. I'm sure that this work in this market, that should work in that market because I've been to that country before. I've been a few times. And
yeah, I went on vacation with my kids, you know, bought a beer and went to a local restaurant. So I understand the whole culture now. I was drunk, but I know the whole culture.
Yeah, that is a lot of times. It's kind of, unfortunately, is a lot of assumptions that carry forward. Or sometimes it's good. Sometimes as you go higher in a position, you need to make decision quick and you need to say, I'm taking that risk. I'm going to make decision based on what I know. And that's fine. But it's kind of like what level of risk that you are actually looking into, right? If you go in wrong, like you say in hindsight, oh no, it's wrong. We need to back up and see how we recover. That sometimes might be too late. Like rather you go out, you might hurt your brand already. It's hard for you to recover. It might be like people are actually done with your brand and you can't do it anymore. So it's really hard to kind of come back to where you are. It's better to that kind of make that decision. Talking about like making assumptions as well, like a lot of times I have a framework where a workshop that I do, like it's called four bucket, but it's more assumptions versus truth. It's that first bucket is the fact that we know is correct. So everyone who say, I know this is because I have facts to back it out. I have numbers and statistics to back it up. Then sure, you can make decision based on what you have in that fact bucket, because it's the truth about that culture. And then you have the strong hypothesis bucket where you actually know enough and you're quite strong enough, but you are not completely sure yet it's a fact. So you probably want to find out, do a bit more validations to make it into fact. And then you have third one is weak hypothesis. So weak hypothesis is like, I think when I'm drunk, I saw that thing, but it might be true, it might not be true. We need to do a bit more research on that. And then the last one would be like unknown bucket, right? So we don't actually know really how people navigate in that area or how to trust. So I do use this as a workshop a lot and get high level management to come in and say, put it in this market, like we're talking about, what do you know and where do you put in? And a lot of them put, I did this once with a company and they put in remotely, they put a lot in the fact bucket because I know it, right? I know it, I'm sure it's like that. And then I start to go through one by one, say, let's go through each of them, who put this and tell us, how do you know this is fact? Do you have something to back up? And then as I going through one with someone, I can see the post-its start to move from fact to strong hypothesis or weak hypothesis because they start to realize that I don't have anything to back it up. Maybe it's a hypothesis, assumptions. So sometimes challenging them in that way actually help them to see what is the gap that we didn't know already that we need to know. Okay, sure. Then to get the answer, let's do a bit of research in understanding that.
You know, my initial reaction to when people come in and say, I want to understand the market is the timing. You know, it's all in the timing. And they tend to do this, most part, not everybody, toward the end, like you're commercializing now, like you're pushing the product out. And as you mentioned earlier, like there are some companies are they need to alter the entire product. So that conversation needs to take place at the beginning of the product development, not at the end when you're trying to market the product to the market, because you may have to go back to the drawing board. It's like building a house and say, okay, I'm going to put, you know, a family of 10 in it, but meanwhile you designed it for two. So what do you do now? You got to go back and redesign the house or build a brand new house. So do you find consultation or advice to your customers has to do a little bit with timing? And do you tell them to encourage them, I guess, to have a conversation with you before they actually think about going to market?
Yeah, it's very fair point. Like a lot of time, it's the examples that you gave is really, really accurate. Like for example, I once encountered a company where they are health related, but more for pregnancy related, like support pregnancy from few months before you get pregnant until you after a year after you deliver the baby and so on. They started as, it was a startup backed by a lot of investors, but they knew that eventually they want to go international because all investors are from different countries. They want to go into their market and so on. But they started with the UK and they did research. They said, oh, we're going to spend a lot of money understanding the market and so on. So they did a lot of research in the UK and they have very good insights to help them to define their propositions, how they want to build their product and so on. But I had to stop them to say, hang on, everything you find is very NHS focused, very British focused in how British medical systems support the pregnant parents and, you know, the and so on. If you build it just as it is now with and then you want to launch in other countries, South America or even Russia or wherever that you wanted to be in at that time, it's not going to work. And the vocabulary that you're going to use and the diet you're going to advise them, there are a lot of traditional advice that their parents are giving them and that is contradict to the medical. And how are you going to do that? So they didn't listen, so they kind of launched it. So what happened when they start to want to launch in the market? They have to rebuild everything. They have to, because the proposition is completely wrong. The technology that they built is so focused on a spec in the UK market. They have to redo everything.
Redo everything.
So, yeah.
No, I don't want to, I hate to bring this up, but in the audience, you probably heard me say this one or two times before. But, you know, when General Motors designed a car called Nova, N-O-V-A, and try to sell it in Mexico, it didn't sell that well. They missed the idea that Nova meaning no go in Mexico. So you wouldn't want to buy a car that goes nowhere. So far this product, I guess it was marketed differently, the wrong way to a market. You probably did not want to expect that from anybody else. So now, you know, that was, I think that was years and years ago. That's in the 80s. We've gone a long way since then. The world is a lot more connected. We're doing research. We're able to find information, right? So, and now, you know, for the localization professionals that they're listening to this conversation, Shui, that they're saying, okay, so we're translating. So should we expand our translation offering to what Shui and Robin are talking about? Or should we just concentrate on doing the translation and let somebody like Bayo Global do the rest of the work? What do you think?
How about collaborations, right? Because what I think is depending on the setup of their company, right? Like it's because it's a slightly different beast. There are overlap between like a lot of localization company who care a lot more about.
Do you use localization services in your work?
I don't do translations.
But I mean, if you're working with a customer and you saw, okay, well, your materials are not. Let's start with this one. You need to put it into another language. Do you recommend translation services? Do you work with?
I will work with them. Like I will recommend if I know anywhere like in a specific market that is reliable, and then as a partner, just like I will recommend like the any partners that actually could offer whatever I don't offer, but I know do a good job. But if not, a lot of company actually have their own translations company or localization company, then I will work very closely with them, because you have to actually provide those kind of insights to localization team to work together. And some localization team, like you have come across, you probably will agree they have different layers or different layers of knowledge. Some companies might have, or some teams might have a better understanding on different culture or specific culture. They will able to provide a bit more information. Some culture, they might have no idea at all where to start. So a lot of times I actually collaborate with the localization company to say, okay, can we work in this way? Or this is a culture insights. How do you run it? I worked with localization team in Google once as a workshop to help them to look further than localizations in terms of language, but it's like what kind of informations you need to know or insights you need to know about a culture, so to help you to do your localizations job or tasks even better. So there are a lot of crossover, but also complement insights and knowledge that actually work very close together. That's why actually talking to in your podcast is actually really useful, because it's kind of like opening another area of relevancy.
I think I'm guessing here the localization industry should use you to study their customers, because they have to get to that, you know, cultural nuances that you're discovering, that you're doing the research on. We talk a lot about on the localization industry about cultural nuances. That's a differentiator. Yeah. Specifically now in the age of AI, where direct translation is pretty much gone. I mean, AI has taken that over. But the nuances, the cultural awareness, the direct correlation between how people think of you as a company or as a business when you come to their market and how their cultures connect to that product, it's really in depth now. Now, this is not nothing that we can actually put it into a mathematical formula and feed it to a large language model, and then it comes out all translated on the other side. It's way beyond that. In your current work right now, you use what you call AI-enabled decision making for global growth. What are you using AI for, if you don't mind expanding on that idea of using AI in your work?
There are a lot of different layers to that, right? Is this area is about research, right? Research people were saying, okay, you can do research. There are a lot of AI moderated platform that say, oh, we can help you to moderate in different languages in a second. When you're sleeping, we can do 10 countries in one go. There's no time zone differences. I have been working with a company, supporting and building, helping them to build the insights and data capabilities for their different markets. One of the things we look into is, say, can we use AI to help to speed up a bit more, streamline a bit more on their research capabilities so that they can talk to their users a bit more and faster turnarounds on. So we do look into the AI moderation tools on that. But saying that we run pilot tests on different platforms to choose one of them that is good, they are still lacking of the nuances. This is what I'm worried about. They can provide you with insights, but there are a lot of nuances that they might miss. For example, is like if someone say that's interesting, is that means that interesting as you are interested, or a politeness of Britishness saying that's interesting, meaning I'm not sure about it. That is what I use interesting in a lot of my context in my conversation, talking to people. If I say, oh, how is that movie? I'll just like, interesting, because I'm not sure. So those kind of things, if AI is transcribing, they say it's interesting, they will say, oh, that is positive, you know? So there's a lot of different culture nuances that AI might not be able to come up with. And then there's an article in The Economist recently that published. There are a few layers that I want to talk about. I love that bit where the example they used. They were talking about you can ask a lot of facts questions with AI, ChatGPT or Claude or whatever. They always come back with an answer, and that is fine. That is fact. But then imagine you ask them about you're having troubles with your in-laws. They did the research. ChatGPT tell you not to worry about winning them over. Keep a respectful distance and don't justify every single to them. But DeepSeek from China will say like, oh, you probably want to seek for compromise because interference from your mother-in-laws or in-laws, maybe it's actually from a genuine concern or they just care about you. That is how Asians show their love. And then they use Mistral, which is the French AI. And it says like, oh, conflict with your in-laws can be draining. Maybe you want to try to journal about your feelings, your frustrations. You can see even AI itself have cultural standpoint. So
that's a very good example. I love that.
I love that. Exactly. I was just like, this is great. This is from the Economist article. I just said, this is so on point. Because I always say I have an accent, right? I'm not really Malaysian, not really British accent. And I always say for years that your product have accent as well. Like accent that you go into different markets, they actually speak in a different way, but not speak in the language or linguistic way, but speak in a different way to different clients. But now AI also have accent because that is depending on where you go and who you ask, they have a very different thing. So I think AI is useful, but in the cultural aspect wise, it's still long way to go. I don't know how fast we're going to get there, but still a lot of nuances that it's not capturing. So I'm actually trying to work out on, there's a system that based on my knowledge where I can allow input all my knowledge, my framework, everything. So if a users or company saying, I'm this company in this category or domain, I'm in the marketing side and I want to grow, I want to make sure my campaign in this area is good. What are the cultural elements or knowledge I need to know? If you ask, I'm doing an experiment. If you just ask ChatGPT or Claude like that, they come back very high level, very superficial or stereotyping because they don't know what to look into, what to challenge. So I'm using my knowledge and everything to challenge the system. So when it comes back, it's actually a bit more founded and more solid. But yeah, I'll let you know when that is ready. It will be good for your
yeah, I would love to do another podcast on this one, Shui.
Exactly. I will reach out and let you know.
I'd love that. Sorry, we're coming up to an end of a conversation here. I'm enjoying this conversation so much. I can talk to you for another day if I have the time and you have the time. And I know it's late in London and it's Friday afternoon. One of my questions for you, if somebody is listening to this conversation right now, let's pretend that they are a localization manager or a global product lead or a CEO of any sort, and they want to push into three markets. And I want to probably take one thing out of this conversation to act on this week or next week. What should that one thing that they should take away from this conversation be?
Challenge your assumption.
challenge assumption. I love that.
Because yeah, that is, because once you have that research, like, okay, then what should we do then? It doesn't always have to be research, or it could be actually getting someone some insight in some way and so on, but not to make assumptions that your assumption is correct. And go and challenge yourself on that. I think that is the very the quickest answer for that. That
absolutely.
You know, like you think about like businesses always have operation risk, legal risks and regulation risk. They never thought about cultural risk. So here.
Yeah, there you go. Add one more risk paradigm. You, where can people find you, Shu Yi, and read the book that you've authored, or perhaps reach out for, you know, if they want to work with Bayo Global, where can they find you, read the book, etc.? And by the way, the book is called, again, Research for Global Growth, right? And she has a copy of it here. She's going to put it on the screen for us. Yeah, there you go.
Research for Global Growth.
Research for Global Growth. So where can people buy the book, find out about you, and maybe reach out to Bayo Global?
So I'm most active on LinkedIn. So you can find Chui Chui Tan, which I believe I can only find another person with the same name. So you should be fine. You should be able to find me. My website is Bayo, BEYO.global. And I also have a YouTube channel, which I actually went through up and down, like posting a lot and then not posting as much. But I'm most active on LinkedIn, and that's where I appear posting things, and reach out to me via DM saying, oh, I heard about you from Localization Fireside Chat and would like to connect or ask questions, or follow me on LinkedIn.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you so much for this particular conversation. It was such an interesting conversation. You're such a pleasant person to talk to. I really enjoyed, genuinely enjoyed having a conversation with you. You are welcome back to the channel, Shui Shui, anytime you want. You know, do you know my booking link? If you have a news you want to share with people, or you just want to have a conversation with me that you want to share with others and record it and have a coffee together, happy to do that anytime you're ready.
I'll do that. Thank you so much, Robin, for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And I hope we covered everything you want to cover. If there's anything you'd like to add, please feel free.
Well, good. We cover a lot, I think. But yeah, look forward to another sessions soon.
Absolutely. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining us. You know, this is pretty interesting conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And if you are coming on our YouTube channel, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the audio channels, thanks for listening in. And thanks for intimately listening in. I hear you guys put your earbuds and you take us with you to the gym. Enjoy your workout while you listen to my voice and Shu Shui Tan here when we post this podcast. Enjoy the workout. And also, just a reminder, I summarize all these conversations in a blog post where you can actually do the research on, you know, what has been talked about in the past. I think we've got almost 300 blog posts out there right now. It's robinayoub.blog. Look it up and subscribe if you want to. And until next time, thank you so much. Appreciate it. It's Friday, July 17. It's pretty hot where I am right now. Hopefully it's sunny where you are, and I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks so much, everybody.